Hey everyone, this is Chris Hall and you're listening to the Downtime Podcast, where we delve deep into the gravity-based side of mountain biking. This week, we're supported once again by Wheel One Composites. Wheel One are making awesome carbon wheels and bars in Kamloops in Canada. I've been using their wheels for 2 years now and they've been absolutely faultless. I've just got their new Faction rim on my new bike and they are a work of art. When you see the quality of the rims, you can really appreciate the love that Wheel One are putting into what they do. Not only are they high quality, but they ride amazing too, getting that perfect balance between stiffness and compliance to give you a wheel that goes where you put it but doesn't feel harsh. I'm a big fan. You can check out what they have to offer over at wheel1composites.com. And as a Downtime listener, they're kindly offering you 15% off all stock wheels and their depackaged bar and stem for the month of June. Just use the code HANDLAID2020 at the checkout. This week's episode is also supported by PNW Components. I run a PNW Bachelor dropper and loam lever remote, and that has easily been the best dropper and lever combo I've ever used. You literally forget it's there because it's so easy to use and it just always works. They've recently launched an update to their Rainier dropper, which has got a simple adjustment allowing you to tune the amount of drop to perfectly fit you and your bike so you can squeeze the most drop possible out of it. And who doesn't want that? You can check out what they have to offer over at pnwcomponents.com. And as a Downtime listener, if you use the code PNWDOWNTIME, 15% off. That's PNWDOWNTIME, all lowercase, all one word. Downtime Live is back next week, so at 8 p.m. BST on Wednesday the 10th of June, you can head to youtube.com/downtime mountain bike podcast and get involved with my chat with Joe Breeden from the Polygon United Ride team. You can ask your questions in advance on my social media or over on Joe's, or during the live broadcast in the chat. Head to youtube.com/downtime mountain bike podcast now and catch up with the past live episodes. If you're not yet subscribed to the podcast, you really should be. It's free, super simple, and it means you'll never miss an episode. Just head to downtimepodcast.com/subscribe and click the button for whatever platform is best for you. Now, I've got some great news for you all. We've got a brand new web store and it is open. I've managed to improve the quality of the t-shirts even more, add some new designs, speed up the shipping and bring down the prices. So I'm super happy with that. It's all still ethical, in fact, probably more ethical than it's ever been. So it's 100% organic. The supply chain's running on renewable energy. It's really, really good stuff. Obviously, don't buy loads of t-shirts if you don't need them. Every t-shirt that's created on this planet uses up resources and water. So don't buy them for the sake of it. But if you want a new t-shirt, if you want to represent the podcast and you want to support what I'm doing, then get involved. Every purchase helps me keep this podcast going and it's a really nice way to support the show. So why not head over now and treat yourself while helping me out at the same time? Make sure you send me some photos of you wearing your new gear because it's awesome to see them. You can find it at downtimepodcast.com/shop. Because of the changes to the store, donations to the show are currently offline. I'll be working on a change there too, so don't worry. If you'd rather contribute in that way, then there will be something coming soon. All right, this week on the podcast, I'm joined by Santa Cruz Syndicate's team manager, Kathy Sessler. Kathy has an amazing history in bikes full stop, and not just in mountain biking. We talk about her early days as a 13-year-old race promoter before BMX had even really started. We chat about her race career, her time working as a stunt woman, and what it's been like to run the Syndicate over the years, working with riders like Nathan Rennie, Steve Peat, Josh Bryson, Greg Minnar, and more recently, Loris and Luca. We even find out about their new no drinking rule, if you can believe it. It's always inspiring to chat to someone who's dedicated their whole life to the sport, and Kathy was no exception. So without further ado, here's Kathy Sessler. Kathy Sessler, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. How's things with you?
Thanks very much for having me. As you know, I probably have a lot of time to do a podcast, so I appreciate you reaching out. It's making my morning a little less like Groundhog Day. It's something new and novel for me, so thank you very much.
Excellent. Yeah, a few people sat around with not quite the usual workload at the moment, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I've been staying busy with little bits and, like slow and steady, let's put it that way. But yeah, I've been itching to get on an airplane, that's for sure.
Yeah, fair play. Well, let's start where we start most of these episodes. Let's wind the clock back and tell us a bit about how bikes became part of your life, because bikes have been big for you for a long time, yeah?
Yeah. The older you get, the more information you have to give. So I've got a lot. So Yeah, obviously I was 5 years old when I rode my first bike without training wheels. And then when I was in my early teens, my stepfather had dirt bikes and he used to take us out camping. I used to love riding my mom's Suzuki 90. And we saw the movie On Any Sunday when it came out. I think it was in 1971 or, yeah, I think that was the year. And seeing the kids on the bicycles there, I'm like, hey, I'm gonna make a little trek down the street for, you know, my brothers and the kids in the neighborhood. It'd just be fun. And I don't know why I thought I would now just become like a little bicycle promoter at the age of 13, but that's what I did. And I have some really great old footage that many people have seen. You can get it on YouTube. I think someone put it up, Lesson in History with Kathy Sessler. It's cool. I've had people
call. It's great.
Yeah, I've had people call and say, oh, it made me cry. Because it is. It's like so pure.
Yeah, it is exactly that. It captures that feeling of riding a bike with your friends as a kid that no other video does as well as that for me anyway.
Yeah, well, thanks for that. And, you know, when you capture just the essence of what's actually going on, the authenticity and then that emotion. And you know, it's like we all were little kids riding bikes. And that's why I think it resonates with probably every bike rider for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So this was on just a little like spare bit of land near where you lived, right? You built a whole track with like little jumps and a mud pit and a water splash. And
yeah, exactly. It was just, I lived in Seal Beach and it was just two vacant lots. You know, you would just put two houses on it. It was very small. And as the track was very small, as the jumps were very small, but you know, in that day it was just all new. And yeah, super, super fun. And then yeah, my dad had an 8mm movie camera, not even Super 8. And so I, you know, I'm like, hey, I'm going to take movies of this. And we just had a blast.
Yeah. And you were kind of emulating motocross, I guess, at this point in time. Like this was before BMX really existed. You were just on bikes that with like motorbike handlebars and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly right. I would phrase this the pregnancy of BMX. The term BMX didn't exist even. And we had been influenced with the dirt bikes and, you know, On Any Sunday and our motocross heroes. And I used to go to motocross races to watch Saddleback, Carlsbad and Lions Drag Strip. It was super cool. But that was where, and then, you know, some of the kids in the neighborhood, they were doing the same thing. Yeah, they were boys and I was a girl, but I'm kind of like a female with a boy inside. That's probably pretty obvious. But yeah, that was our influence and we just had so much fun. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. And did you stick with riding those kind of those bikes, those BMX bikes as you grew up? Or did bikes become like a lesser part of your life for a bit? Because there's like I'm trying to piece together the gap between or what happened between those early days and the BMX sort of craze into you getting mountain biking as part of your interests.
Yeah, well, you've done your homework anyways. Yes, I never rode BMX. My dream was to race in the Elsinore Grand Prix on the motorcycle. And actually, when I was 14, I did do that. And I wanted to race motocross. It was less about bicycles as it was about the motorcycles. But I was young. I couldn't do it myself. I had no money and my parents weren't into it. They had to work. And so I never had a motocross career. And then through high school, so taking me the next few years through high school, I just would go to the motocross races and I would watch. And I had some friends and family friends that we would just have a good time. So that's the gap. What I was doing was going to motocross races. And then one of those friends started doing triathlons in those early years. It would have been the early 80s. And I'm like, okay, I'll try that. And I don't know what the hell I ever thought that would be fun for, because they're not that fun if you've ever done one. I mean,
when that's a bit much for me.
Yeah, it's not that fun. You're getting up so early and you're out of like, jump in the ocean and be kicked in the face with 2,000 people and you're swallowing water. And I didn't find it very fun, yet I did many of them. And then I had two children, I had two little girls, And after, you know, they were about two or three, I'm like, okay, I need to get back in shape, and signed on for a few more triathlons. And having the goal of an event to target some training for was super helpful to get fit. And then my friend was doing a mountain bike race. And I'm like, okay, well, it was the desert to the sea. It was like a 100-mile race. And we went to go watch a certain part as they went through Lake Elsinore. And so it looked like just guys riding their bikes down the road, getting to the next bit of trail, right? But somehow it intrigued me. And I thought, oh, this mountain bike thing, this could be something. And then a friend of mine, she had bought her husband a new mountain bike. And she had paid like $500 for it. And I thought, oh my God, you are crazy. And she had the old bike to sell. She sold it to me for $50. And so my husband and I moved up to the hills where we're at right now in Murrieta in California. And one day I said, you know, I mean, the thing sat in the garage for months. And one day I'm like, you know what? I've never been on these trails. I'm going to go check it out. And I got on that bike and I rode up this fire road, and it was hard. But I was just, well, I'd never explored this area. So I kept climbing. And when, you know, what happens when you start climbing, you get to descend. And the minute I started descending, I'm like, oh my God, why did not anybody tell me how fun this is? Like, this is like, I'm racing mountain bikes now. This is what I'm going to do. I came home, was just like so excited. I told my husband what I just told you now. And months after that, I did my first mountain bike race and haven't left the sport since.
How did it go? What was that first race like?
The first race was in October at the Fall Classic at Big Bear. And I raced, I think they convinced me, my friends, the guys around the neighborhood convinced me, like, yeah, don't race beginner, just race sport, you know, you're good. And I'm sure got second place. I didn't win it, but it was fun. It was a cross-country race.
Yeah.
Super, super fun. And people that I met even at that race are friends today.
And, that's awesome.
Yeah, it was so fun. I'm like, yep, I'm hooked. And so that was like, I think, what would that have been? 1989?
Okay. Yeah. So you came to mountain biking and to racing fairly late. I guess you already had a young family.
Yeah.
Was it hard at that point to balance family life and racing?
No, I'll say no. Because at that point in time, the professionalism of the sport, I mean, it was just being born as well. And if you had some skills as a woman, you could advance really quickly. Because, you know, think about the how many men are out there, right? And the percentage of, like, if you're good, you've got a lot of field to work through. So I would say I was able to turn pro really quickly. And do it in my own way. Like, I wasn't going to be racing in Europe, you know, with two small kids at home. But he was able to advance and just have a really, really great time. And, you know, I was never going to be top five pro person. But I would say my training program, I probably trained 10 hours a week, you know, so
okay.
Intervals and things like that, which are, they're not fun, but necessary. So if you're efficient with your time with the kids, you can balance it. So yeah, it was all right. Yeah.
Impressive work. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you were the first pro to race an intense bike. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah. Obviously Sean Palmer takes it to a whole nother level, but I was riding bikes. So yeah. So when I was having my babies, I lived in a place called Canyon Lake. The girl across the street used to babysit my kids. Her boyfriend was Jeff Stieber. And so I actually knew of Jeff before either of us were involved with bikes. And so some years had passed. I had started riding mountain bikes. And this gal, Lisa, she had done my hair from time to time. So I'm getting my hair done. She goes, hey, you know, my old boyfriend, Jeff, you know, he's making mountain bikes now. I'm like, oh, really? Oh, that ought to be great, right? You know, anybody just making mountain bikes. Oh, swell. Because I didn't know that much about him. So we were out at a local race in Temecula and we're driving down the freeway. Well, we saw Jeff and we're like, hey, and his bike. I'm like, oh my God, you really are making mountain bike. Look at that. I'm like, we got to meet. We got to talk. So we met up and he says, yeah, I'd be happy to give you a bike and I'll be back in a week with it. And he went home and he made it on his kitchen table and he came back in a week. I often laugh and say that might've been the only intense frame ever delivered on time. But anyways, yeah. And so that's how I became the first pro rider for Intense.
Amazing. Yeah. So how did the race career go then? You were quite successful, right?
Well, okay. So in those times, I would say yes for myself. I was super satisfied and I gathered sponsors that supported me financially. So I would call that successful. Yes. And I rode for KHS for a time. And then I was the first Maxxis girl when I was on KHS, Maxxis tires. A friend of mine, Marcus Kreider, who we would see at the races, he started working with Maxxis tires, and Maxxis sponsored me with tires on KHS, and so I was the first person. And at that time, Maxxis didn't really make such a good mountain bike tire. We were using Chenxing was the factory, and so I was using looked like an old Panaracer Smoke knockoff kind of thing. I used that a lot while they developed their line, and you know they've had great success, of course. But those were some very early times. That would have been in '95. And then in those days, I was over 35, and at national championships and world championships, their categories, they had veteran categories. So that was people over 35. And we would be recognized with official world championship titles. Unfortunately for myself, there was 2 years where I was the fastest veteran, but we didn't have enough countries represented. So they disqualified our class, which really made me sad because I really earned. And it was really cool too. They had the rainbow jersey. The rainbow was in a V, like for veteran. It was super cool. And that's super sad for me that I don't have a couple of those. But
yeah, that feels like you've been cheated a bit from that one.
I feel like that. I mean, they invited the whole world. I mean, how many old women over 35 are showing up? I'm sorry if four countries show up. That's not my fault. But then we would race with the seniors and I'd be like, I don't know, like around 20th or something. But that would be because I'd be so depressed. I'd be out drinking the night before or something. Once I found out they disqualified our class, I was like, oh my God. Okay. But I did learn to drink wine, red wine there. I never drank red wine in my life, but we were in Metabier, France in 1993. And yeah, so I was like, oh, not enough people. I'm like, oh shit, I'm getting drunk.
Yeah, how was the first red wine hangover?
It was great. Super muddy track, flat pedals. Woo, it was so fun.
And the bikes really weren't up to the job back then either, were they? Even though the courses were probably not quite up to what they are now, but
no,
they were pretty full on bikes that weren't really made for it.
Well, I would say it was equal. They were equal to each other, right?
Okay.
The bikes were equal to the level of the course. And I think, you know, the bikes and the technology drives the courses and the changes that you see. That's what I think. Yeah, because you just make do. I mean, certainly you couldn't ride a bike like that down a downhill track these days. No, but I would venture to say I think it would be super fun if we got like our guys on 26-inch bikes and got them on a racetrack. I still bet they'd do pretty good. I don't think they'd win on them, but I bet they'd do pretty good. Because they're just talking about pilot versus equipment. But the bikes, let's just say we didn't have a lot of suspension, no.
Or brakes that worked.
Or brakes that worked. But it was fun though.
Cool. And so obviously a pretty successful race career. And then at some point, you ended up involved in stunt work. How the hell did that happen?
Oh my gosh. You know, this is like such an interesting story because I couldn't even make that happen. somewhere along in my life, someone suggested like, write down your goals on a piece of paper. And I put out these outlandish goals. Oh, I want to make $50,000 a year racing mountain bikes. I want to be a stunt woman on Pacific Blue. And, you know, every, like there was like 20 items on my list, all but one of those things came true. And so I really kind of think it's true when you start putting your intention out in the universe, like you maybe don't know how it's going to manifest and you can't maybe manifest it, but I'm telling you what, it was very interesting. So I was still racing. And I think we were at Interbike and I met a person. He wanted to be like my agent or whatever. And I'm like, oh, that's kind of weird. But he was working for Pacific Blue at the time. And for those who don't know, Pacific Blue was a show about cops on mountain bikes and kind of like Baywatch on bikes. It's super corny, but super fun. And anyway, we exchanged numbers and he called me one day. Hey, they're having auditions up here for the stunt people. You know, you should come up. So I go up and nothing happens with it. The guy just looked at the group of us. He says, are you in SAG? Are you in SAG, which is Screen Actors Guild? And, you know, for those who said no, he says, oh, thank you very much. Goodbye. And because you've got to work in that industry with the members of the Screen Actors Guild. And that's the first thing. Now, there are things that if you can't find the people you need inside Screen Actors Guild, you can reach outside of it. So anyway, following year, get a call, hey, come out, doing auditions, da da da. Kind of the same thing happened and nothing. And so the show's going on a couple of years. And then I get a call from a different friend. And he says, you know what? It was like 9 a.m. He's like, hey, they've got a new stunt coordinator. They're doing some auditions today at 12. You should go down there. And my first reaction would be, oh, God, you know, that's a long way to go and just all this again. And no, you know, like, if you don't go, it's a guaranteed no, right? So, you know what? I think I'll take my chances. And so I drove down to LA and got there in time and met the stunt coordinator. And he's like, you're hired on the spot. Because I looked so much like the girl. Eddie Fiola had been doubling the girls because, I mean, Eddie's an incredibly talented bike rider, of course, and he's smaller in stature. So he was getting away with, you know, being able to double girls. But this new stunt coordinator says, no, we need to find a woman to double the women. Sorry. And so I got hired to be Darlene Vogel, who is the blonde lead in the show. And then the girl they hired for Paula Tricky, the brunette, she worked one day and Paula Tricky says like, I'm not a size 2 and you're going to be having that girl who's a size 12 doubling me. So that was that girl's last day. And then I started doubling then all the girls. And so I did over the course of 3 seasons, did about 40 episodes and it was so much fun. So that overlapped. That started in 97 when I was just 97 was also my last year racing. And so I segued from racing into doing the stunt work for 3 years. So that was super fun. And in a way, it was just it kind of like the preparation too from racing that prepared you really well for the stunt work because you would go and maybe you would have a vague idea what you had to do. Like, oh, maybe you got to jump over a car or do a crash or a chase or something. But it's pretty much you'd always get there and then you get that the nerves and the anticipation, but then things would always change. So you'd be very adaptive and it was good. It's very exhilarating. Very, very fun. Yeah. And then you felt so proud when you pulled it off, right? You know, I tackled this one guy once and my stunt coordinator was like, wow, that's the best tackle I've ever seen. And you look at the playback and you're like, oh my God, it looks like it broke my freaking neck.
And you trained for it as well. Am I right in thinking you built jumps in your garden to practice?
Yes. Because my first day on the job, they're like, okay, today you're going to chase this guy and you're going to jump on him and tackle him to the ground. And then tomorrow you got to jump over that table. And, you know, in those days, remember this was a long time ago, there weren't jumps in the tracks. And so I had not developed that skill. And then, you know, you got to get off and tackle guys and run and like, you need to be on flat pedals. And anyway, stunt coordinator's like, you go learn to jump. I'm like, okay. And so, yes, I did. I've got 5 acres here. And so I told my husband like, okay, we need to build some jumps. But see, on the show, we would do wooden ramps, right? Just flat jumps. So I would build like the dirt tabletop and stuff. and then just put the plywood up to it. So then I would just hit it, so it would be the same takeoff, right? And So the next day I go to jump over this table, and I just looked at my friend who was helping do the camera stuff, and I'm like, "You got to help me." He goes, "I got some toe clips." I'm like, "Sweet." So strapped me down. So I jumped over the table. It was only little, but yeah. Then I learned how to jump, and then the biggest jump I did for the show was jumping over a Hummer side by side with Wayne Crosdale. And he did a lot of the episodes with me, and oh my God, we laughed so hard. I mean, Syndicate's great, right? I mean, whatever you think about the Syndicate and how much fun we have on the Syndicate, I had even more fun working with Wayne and on this show. I had abs of steel because I'd be laughing just constantly at all the pranks, and these guys were so funny. But anyway, back to the jump. So that jumping over the Hummer side by side, it was just like a plywood ramp. It was like 6 feet tall. The gap was 15 feet. And then we had a landing ramp that was like 2.5 feet. And the morning of, you know, we're, you know, getting ready to shoot it, and we're doing our run-ups to it. And, you know, we've got to build all the speed, right? And then as soon as you hit the ramp, you decelerate in essence. So you got to really make like extra speed, and you're just generating all yourself. So we're ready. And then like lunch, we're fucking ready, dude. And now we got to wait a couple hours and then go back. And then after lunch, and then do it all again. And well, and of course we did. And I made that landing by like 2 inches.
Whoa.
Hey, well, hey, you know, but I give a lot of credit to Wayne to just be brave enough to have some 42-year-old woman next to him jumping a fucking Hummer.
Was that the most dangerous stunt that you did, do you think, for Pacific Blue?
No, I don't think it was. That one wasn't dangerous. I mean, the potential was there. But, you know, the thing with the stunt work, it's everything is safety, safety, safety. And they're really looking out to make sure you're safe and not getting hurt. God, you know, yes, I wouldn't say there was danger, right? Some stunts you're going to get hurt more than others just because you're hitting the ground. And some of the harder ones were like the tackles. They were hard because like if you're on the bike and doing a transfer from the bike to the person and trying to tackle them is hard because you can't push off on the top tube, right? So it's kind of tricky. Like if it was a horse, the horse is pretty steady, right? If you had to jump off a horse, you could push off. But those are hard. I would say those are a little more dangerous actually than the jumping.
Play.
Yeah.
Did you? Yeah. From all the injuries you've ever had, then what was the worst one? And was it from stunts or was it from racing?
None of the above.
Drinking.
Yes, I would say yes. Probably, yeah, that probably always had a little something to do with some injuries. No. Actually, my worst injury was a little over a year ago. We were with a team. We had been in Lusa testing, and we went back to Lisbon to fly out of Lisbon early the next morning. And we're in a hotel, and Greg, you know, he's great with the cocktails, and you know, our week was over, and honestly I didn't get hurt because I was drinking too much. But it's just a funny story to tell it that way. But we're having a few drinks in the lobby, and then the guys get the idea, like, oh, let's get the scooters and let's, you know, run around Lisbon. And I'm like, hey, you know what, I love walking, you just tell me where you guys are going to end up and I will meet you there. I'm like, come on, Sassy, come on, come on. I'm like, nope, not gonna do it. No, I'm not getting on one of those things. I'm not. And then Greg looks and is like, okay, fine, then just jump on the back of mine with me. I'm like, okay. I mean, I don't know how that sounded more sensible, but it did. So, anyway, so we're going down the main drag in Lisbon, and then we get on these cobblestones, and anyway Greg says, like, we're doing 30 k's an hour. I'm like, this is not safe. But I trust you because now we're doing 30Ks. I have no other choice but to trust you. And, you know, it's funny too. And then eventually we came across a parade. So it turns out they're having carnival and streets are shut down and it's really exciting and all kinds of festivities everywhere. And eventually, and you know, Loris and Luca and Marcy and everybody, you know, we're all going all over the place and we kind of meet up. And then Greg's scooter was out of batteries. So anyways, he's getting another one. I thought, you know what, that is not safe on there. And I see all these other like tourists on these things. I'm just going to get my own, which I did. And so we continue going around Lisbon. And if you've ever been there, there's a real steep cobblestone hill with like a cable car that goes up and down. And we went down this thing and we're going, I'm like, oh my God, this is not safe, but like, hold on, I'm committed. Right. And then we're around the town and did all the dangerous stuff. And then following Greg and he turns down a street. He's going the wrong way on a one-way street. I'm like, okay, cool, but cars are coming. So I'm just going to pull up this driveway and just kind of go onto the sidewalk. And it was the littlest curb. It wasn't even like a half an inch. Somehow the angle I hit it or whatever, you know, I've never ridden these scooters. I should have pulled apart. It would have been fine. I just kind of leaned back, kind of chill, like maybe you would have done on a bike or something for a little thing. But there's no suspension on those things. And the wheel just sudden stop, like just dead stopped. And I was left foot forward and just kind of like that. And then the force of the impact went through my leg and just kind of exploded my knee. Oh. And then subsequently I just fell off and I was going slow and it's just this little roll. And then I'm sat there and Loris pulls up and Dougie Fresh pulls up and they look at me and they're like, are you okay? I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm like, yeah, my knee is kind of, I don't know. I don't think it's good. And, I wasn't screaming in pain or anything like that. And Laura says, can you walk? I'm like, I don't know. I don't think so, but you know, help me up and let's try. And the first step, it felt like this isn't what happened, but it felt like my femur was sliding off my tibia. That's what it felt like. Ooh. I'm like, oh no, my leg's not working. No, not working. Mm-mm. No. And so we were, there was like a little cafe just like a few yards away. And so I'm like, just help me get in there. And by this time, Greg has doubled back and they're helping me in there and sat up at like a bar stool thing. And I look at Greg and I'm like propping myself up on the table. And I look and I'm like, I'm going to pass out. Don't let me hit the ground. Okay. And he's like, his eyes got real big. And it's like, okay, I'll get you some orange juice or something. I'm like, I'm not a fucking diabetic, but anyway, thank you for the thought. But, anyway, so I kind of recovered from that. So my body was just completely shocking and kind of came, like, I didn't pass out, kind of came around, but anyways, the guys, we sat at like a little corner booth and they needed to eat anyway. I wasn't going anywhere. And I just said, okay, guys, here's what we need. I need crutches, some ibuprofen, and some knee brace and elastic because I'm flying the next morning. You're not going to go to a doctor right now. And, you know, knees, I mean, they're not going to do anything. There's going to be days before you can get an MRI. So I'm like, let's just chill and, you know, deal with it. So turns out when I did go to the doctor, I had fractured the tibial plateau, torn my MCL, but not completely. I'd torn some ACL, not very badly. But yeah, that was my worst injury.
Good effort. Yeah. Is it back to normal now?
No, it's not. I don't know. It's weird. Yeah, so we did that in March. And then this March, so almost exactly a year later, I'm in LA and I'm just walking along, minding my own business. And my knee just exploded. I did nothing. Ooh. I did nothing and it just blew up and I still don't know what happened because then that's all the COVID stuff. I'm like, well, I'm not going to go to the doctor for this, but you know, it's calmed down. So I just been doing a lot of, I walk every day and ride my bike a little bit and just kind of being chill because that's only been a couple months. So the swelling's gone down a lot and it's feeling a lot better, but she's funky.
Whoa, sorry to hear that.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, I can do all that racing and all that crashing and all that stunt work. No, riding a scooter.
Scooter. Yeah.
Scooter time. Yeah, that's what happened. That's what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Always the way. Let's talk a little bit about the team management side of things then, because that started off with Intense, I think. Yeah. For you?
Yeah. So transitioning from then the Pacific Blue Times, Jeff, because he's been my friend for life, he could use some help. Well, Darren Stockton, he was a teammate of mine on Outland, and he was working for Intense Tire Systems, and he was putting together a team. And in fact, it was interesting because Jeff was doing obviously the bikes and the Intense Tire Systems tires. And Darren wanted to start a team, but I think at the time, Jeff couldn't support it with all the frames and bikes that they needed. So Darren reached out to Rob Roskopf at Santa Cruz Bicycles. And so that first year was, I think, 2003, something like this. Darren asked me, hey, do you want to help manage the team? I said, yeah, absolutely. And yeah, we had a lot of fun. That's how that started. And then they weren't going to do the tires anymore with the team. That team was going away. So Roskopf wanted to keep a team. And so 2004 was the first year of the syndicate. And Rob asked me, like, hey, do you want to still be the team manager? I'm like, yeah, absolutely. I'll do that.
Sweet. And it was a hell of a team that, well, it's been a hell of a team ever since. But that year, I think you had Nathan Rennie, Kurt Vores, Cam Zink, Henry O'Donnell, Johnny Waddle. You had a cross-country rider as well, Mark Hendershot.
Yeah. He was into the 24-hour racing. So we covered a lot of ground with that team. Yeah. We had a lot of fun. Oh, man. Yeah, laughing.
What was
it
like those first few years then? Because that's a big team, big characters. Yeah. It must have been a steep learning curve.
Well, I remember what I said earlier about like a boy inside a female body. I get it. I understand them. And you also have to understand like where they're coming from and their different ages. And I think it's really important to embrace where everybody's at. If you try and have people conform, then you lose creativity and you lose some essence. So I think that's one thing Syndicate's always been about, is embracing the unique individual and supporting them. And so you've got characters like Cam Zink. I mean, no one's containing him. No one's containing Rennie. I'm just there to kind of steer them around, really. You know, and try and get them out of trouble when they're in trouble. And sometimes myself get them in trouble, and then get us all out of trouble. I mean, it's just the way it was. Is.
Yeah. Yeah. What drove it then to be more downhill focused in the sort of current format? Why did the cross country element of it disappear?
Yeah, Roskopf loves like that high intensity, like F1, this and that, and downhill to him has always been big in his heart, and because the progression with the bikes and all the challenges, that's always been dear to him. And so it took that direction. Yeah. It took that direction through Rob's passion, I would say.
Okay. Yeah.
I share that passion. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Me too.
Yeah.
And from there, then you ended up bringing in a few more characters and a few people dropped out, and you ended up with, I think, what the syndicate really means to a lot of people still, perhaps, and that was the three-way of Steve, Greg and Josh. And it seems to be at that point that was when the syndicate really started to almost become its own brand, and it really took off in people's eyes. What do you think drove that?
I mean, I would completely agree with that statement in every way. That is just naturally the course it took, right? And why is that? Because of those personalities and allowing them to be uniquely themselves and support them to be the best they could be. And, I've got to say they're all very authentic, right? And Josh in particular really captured a lot of people's hearts, didn't he? And and Steve, the legend that he is, and then Greg, the ability he has to have that mind control and the consistency he has to win races is a combination I don't think it will ever be matched. It's just, it's evolved, and we have fabulous team now with a lot of the same elements. But yeah, that was a very special time. And yeah, very lucky to have been a part of that.
Yeah. How big of an influence, How big of an influence do you feel Joe Bowman was in that time? Because he was getting behind the videos and, you know, doing more and more of the marketing side.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we had a lot of great, we had John Lawler and other fabulous filmers and stuff before that. But then I remember Steve's like, hey, this kid, you know, he lives by me and he wants to get involved. And I'm more like, everything's closed, you know, we don't want too many people in, and and that's just kind of my nature, because I don't want to dilute things and then just have, you know, yeah, you know how many requests I get from people just like, hey, you know what, and I'll do this and I'll come around and for free, and if I could, and like, yeah, I know a lot of people do that, but so I tend to be a little more defensive, and this is how it kind of was at first. It's like, yeah, no, let's give Joe a try and have him come around. And how brilliant is Joe Bowman? Oh my God. And so he just started, he was barely a child when he started with this. And with Petey's show, This Is Petey, like, how good was that? And then yeah. Joe has gone on to do his own film, and he gets the syndicate. He can be there like a fly on the wall, right? You can be yourself around him, and he knows what content to put out there, so you know we can show it all, but he knows how to edit it and portray the authenticity without all the stuff that may get us in trouble. Yeah, he's brilliant, and for him to now, he's really the face of the syndicate, in the sense that he puts out the visuals what the public see, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, without Joe Bowman, and he's been working really, really hard through all this for us, through this COVID stuff, because, and the riders as well, we're like, okay, if we can't go racing, we're team to market bikes and sell bicycles, man, you should see the list of media content these guys are doing and working their social media, as you've seen. And Joe Bo is a very instrumental part of making that happen for us. So yes, thank you, Joe.
Yeah, fair play, good stuff. Yeah. So yeah, the syndicate definitely feels more like a family than a team, and that, I think I include everyone in that, not just the riders, and it, yeah. And in that way it really stands out from the rest of the paddock. I think, was that a conscious decision from the start, and if so, by who, or has it just evolved like that?
I would say it wasn't a conscious decision. I would say it's a natural course based on Rob Roskopf and my talents, wishes, dreams, goals, values. Let's just say it's a natural kind of thing to have like-minded individuals as a part of the syndicate that also get it. So it's just kind of like seeks like, and yeah, it's just kind of a harmonious thing that I think naturally is there from the inception. And when you're also, when you're traveling with this many people, it is a family, and other teams too have family styles. They do. But ours has got a very long standing, and you know, and I'm the mom and I'm cooking and I'm cleaning their clothes and all this, but you know, these are very important roles in the structure of the team, and you've got to love one another and trust one another. And the family style, and I'm glad it shows through if you're speaking about it. I'm very glad that that shows through, because I think this is a very important aspect, what makes Syndicate unique and wonderful.
Yeah. And do you think it makes other people want to be part of it? It's got that warm feeling.
Yeah, I believe that does make other people want to be a part of it. Absolutely, I do. Yeah. And one of the reasons why people want to come join. Luca and Loris both said they had posters on the wall and they wanted to be on our team for years, and that their dreams have come true. Now, maybe they don't like me being their mom sometimes. after all, the reality might be, the fantasy might be better than the reality. But, but that's real. It's real.
Yeah. Do you have any rules for your team members then?
Very, very few. This just comes down to like, basically, the team house is for team only, because you think about it, you have 10 team members, and if everybody has their spouse, significant other, or friend drop by, then that turns to 20 people, right? And so it's just like it's our office, kind of our workspace, just kind of, you know, respect that. Not to say people don't drop by, hey, yeah, stop for dinner or whatever, you know, it's not a strict thing, but it's just more like a general kind of a respectful kind of thing. And I think this year, since the season didn't start, it was going to start with, hey, no drinking during the week, but, you know, after the race, go for it. And that's a new rule that's been implemented that we haven't had a chance to try yet, quite frankly.
Okay. What's brought that about?
I think it's just we want to minimize, like, distractions and keep everybody fresh. And, you know, I'll tell you what, moving forward, you know, coming up, you know, through this COVID thing, when we do go racing again, from my perspective, it's going to be very, very important to just keep the whole, everybody's immune system up. Right.
Yeah.
And so I've got ideas for, you know, foods and things and thus, but drinking's not going to really help your immune system either. So I think, you know, if we carry on with that rule, I think it'll be it'll be multifaceted, but I don't know. Look at the cast of characters. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah, be a good challenge.
I didn't make up the rule, so but I'm happy to abide by it if that's how they like it. So no problem.
Yeah. Play. Yeah. Well, you had a bit of a challenge a couple of years ago with the syndicate, I guess. So Steve and Josh, two-thirds of the riding part of the team, moving on to other things. And I guess with that, there's a bit of a risk around keeping that family vibe and keeping what the syndicate was all about, which you've managed to do really well. How did you approach that? How did you choose the replacements, and what did you do in your role to help that team gel?
Yeah. Okay. So to answer that, yeah, when Steve and Josh were exiting, and, you know, we weren't expecting Josh to exit, right? We knew Steve was going, but that same year, Josh was, and, you know, he just wasn't feeling it in his heart anymore. And he needed to do the last few races, and I had a lot of compassion for him just to help him get through those races safely, really was my concern. And then at that time, first we were thinking, we're going to need another rider to replace Steve. And Greg and I had some nice times with Lucas Shaw, and obviously he's young, great talent. And so we definitely had our eyes on him. And then coming around Mount St. Anne time, like the last World Cup, we're like, dang, you know, Rat Boy's, you know, going. Now I don't make the decisions of who the riders are, you know, that comes from Ross Kopp and Will Ockleton and stuff. But we were chatting with Will, and he's like, yeah, you know, we've got this base in France, and, you know, I'm talking to Loris Vergier. I'm like, awesome. Oh, that would be so cool. Luca and Loris, that would be pretty awesome. And so, yeah, so obviously, you know, it did happen. So I didn't have a role in making the decision other than saying, like, yeah, I like those ideas. But, then you saw our launch video. Okay. So we bring these guys out. They weren't even 21 at the time, right? They were young, they're babies. And they come out and we put all these costumes on them, and they're like embarrassed, and they went with it. And, you know, I think it's the funniest launch video of all time. they really lend themselves well to like the family atmosphere. Fear is something they've wanted to come to, and they very much embrace it. And I love them too.
They've settled in very well. Did you do anything specific to help, like, get them part of the team, like a team building kind of thing? Or
No, we just brought them out to Santa Cruz and did that launch video. That was the first group meeting, right? And then it's boom, right off into racing. So, I mean, from that aspect, you know, that was a week of getting to know one another. So, I mean, you could say, yeah, I could answer that question and say yes. But yeah, this, yeah, but that video was kind of the whole start of it. And, but, you know, it's like, you know, these people through the season, you know, a bit anyways, you know, it's not like they're complete strangers coming in and they've got a pretty good idea what they're coming into. And it, you know, it seemed pretty natural, to be honest. It just kind of flowed right into getting down to business and giving them the support.
Yeah. Yeah. As a fan, it feels very normal to have those guys with Greg on the syndicate now, very much so.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's great. They're great. Oh my God. They're funny.
Cool. So in your opinion then, what do you think is important for a rider to perform well over a race week?
Well, they, you know, they all have a lot to go through and they're all, I'll say this word again, individuals. So they all have a different approach, different things that are important to them. Like they're all eating the same food. I mean, I give them all the same food, but you know, they're all going through their different process. So, and like we've got Laura who is amazing and she's taking care of each of their bodies individually, what they need. So there's, what I'm trying to say is we try and provide a framework and a structure for them to all operate to their best abilities with their own kind of demons or whatever they're faced with. So yeah, I think just to say what's important is just to provide a solid foundation for them to work it through and then to be successful in their race. You know, if you come first or last, if you've given it the very best you can, then that's a win, you know? And Loris, like, oh my goodness, the injuries he worked through last year. Whoa, that guy. Yeah. When we were in, the last race of the year. And he had been working, racing still with this hand issue and wow, the mental fortitude he pulled out to do so well and then finish the series fifth overall. Wow. That's incredible. Right.
It's a strong lad.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So do you tailor your own approach for each of the different riders within the team then? Would you say you work differently with all the three of them?
Yeah, I would say I do. I would say I try to treat them all equally fairly. And I would say it sometimes people think I favor Greg more than the others. I don't think I favor him more than the others. He's a really great friend of mine and we've worked together for a very long time. But when it comes to the racing, because they are different, I can't treat them the same because they're different. It wouldn't work to me.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they would be subtle things, right? You know, but if Loris wants dessert or doesn't want dessert, you might see that reflected. No. I'm washing all their clothes the same. I don't know. They're just different. Sometimes you could see, say, Loris struggling with a certain aspect. Maybe it's whatever it may be. And so you want to be, I think with the injuries, it was a lot. It was really hard. So you want to be really compassionate and really supportive to him. Whereas Greg didn't have that need or Luca didn't have that need. But then Luca had different things going on, so you try and support, you know, that and on. So yeah, I would say I treat them differently, but I aim to try and treat them fairly.
Yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. What do you think about the pit infrastructure? Because a lot of the teams have got big flashy trucks and, you know, all singing, all dancing pit setups. And you guys have made some big steps in recent years, but for a long time, you had a very, you know, very basic compared to some of the big teams pit setup, but you were still putting out, you know, some of the best performances in the pack. So
yeah,
is the investment in that side of things because you think it will help or just because it looks better from a marketing perspective? Like what are your thoughts on that?
That's a great perspective that you share because it just goes to show that it's really all about the racer, right? You know, if the racer is going to do well, sometimes they don't need all that stuff. The reason we went to a bigger truck and the things that we did was simply out of necessity. We could no longer legally carry all the weight in the truck and trailer or the van and trailer that we had. and different countries have different regulations and whatnot. We had to have a bigger vehicle to be safe and legal, and says nothing to do with how it looks. Great, it looks good, but that's a byproduct. And if you look inside our pits too, you know, it's not super flashy. It's, you know, we've got what we need, and it's so cool. Like Marshy and PA, they've done the build out inside the truck. They, you know, they've put so much of themselves into it and their talents. It's really cool. But we definitely didn't do it out of trying to make the riders feel better. I mean, if they're going to go race well, they're going to race well no matter what they're in. If they're a little more comfortable, that's a really nice thing.
Yeah. So do you think there's certain things then that like amateur riders or privateers can do to get some of that benefit of being within a team without having, you know, without being able to get onto a big team and having all that infrastructure around them? What sort of things could, I don't know, your average Joe go and do to make their race week better? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. I would just like to say to people like that is, it's not about having all the infrastructure. And if you're looking at others and your competitors, if that infrastructure is making them better than you, now there's something to talk about, right? So if you want to go race and race your heart out, you're going to be able to do it under an easy app, my friend. So I would say that to them. Would you be more comfortable or less comfortable? Sure. But if you have the heart to race and you've trained well and you have skills, and if you have really great skills and great results, you'll eventually be under that type of infrastructure. But if you're viewing it as an obstacle to your success or that it would help you be more successful, I don't agree.
Yeah, good answer. I like that. Yeah. Yeah, don't need all the bells and whistles to do well.
You do not. Yeah. You just have to do well. You have to do well.
Easier said than done. Yeah.
and I think it's like, you know, I've been in this sport for a really long time, and I think you see people come along and you're like, oh, they have it. Like, you know, Luca Loris, they have it. Greg has it. You know, we've been very lucky that all our riders have it. Right. So
do they all have it in the same way, or do they have it differently?
Oh, like, differently. Totally differently. Yeah. All completely different. Yeah.
But have you seen common themes in what makes riders successful over the years?
Well, yeah. What I would say is you see it at a very early age. It's just going to be something about their inherent physiology and maybe their exposure. Like Luca has long history of, you know, BMX and being on bikes, and he's strong, and you know, he's come into it. But like Sam Hill, you know, comes on the scene. I remember my friend saying, oh, you should see this kid from Australia. You know, Sam Hill is junior and buddy, yada, yada. He had it. Greg had it. Josh had it. Remember, Josh was like 13 or 14 when Steve was mentoring him. And Roskopf was telling me about, hey, there's this kid, Josh. Look at this video of him. Look at him on the bike. Okay, it's just there. I just don't think that you can take someone with good talent and, yeah, you can work with them and train them up and get them a little better, but I don't think those are going to be your winners. I don't know. That's just my theory.
Yeah. Yeah. It's more than just riding ability though, isn't it? There's other elements.
Yeah. I think I used to say the most screwed up childhoods produce the best champions. And I think I say that thinking of Sean Palmer. Yeah, you gotta have something to overcome, something to drive you so hard. Like, okay, if you were just like super squared away and you just love riding your bike and you want to go do a race, sorry, I don't think you're going to do as good as the person who has something to prove.
You know, interesting. Yeah, a bit of adversity can go a long way.
Well, yeah, I think so. And I'm not saying you should go have a crummy childhood to make a champion. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that people with a strong drive are trying to prove something to others, and eventually they'll see it that it's for themselves. And yeah, that's my perspective.
Fair enough. So like you mentioned earlier, we're in the middle of this slightly strange global pandemic. What does that do for someone whose job is running an international race team? How does that change life for you?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, what's been really, really great is the 15 elite team managers and some other very smart managers in the sport. We've been having a lot of Zoom meetings and talking about these interesting new challenges and how everybody's navigating. And I think just from my observation is, okay, we're packed, ready to get on airplanes for Lusa, right, when this thing unfolds. And so there's shock, and then there's like, what, and when's the next thing? And now, I won't call it complacency, but we've been locked down for so long. It's just an understanding that we just must wait, be patient. And what's really awesome about the sport and these group of managers, and really most everybody in this sport, is it is one big global family as well. And we all have the same interests in mind, and we're all friends, and we all want to work together and unify and not undercut others in these hard times. It's a beautiful thing. And so,
cool.
Yeah. And then sharing knowledge and trying to find out about, the new changes with the schedules and stuff. And so I'll tell you, we expect to see the new World Cup schedule tomorrow, and expect to see a very busy September and October, and expect to see a lot of World Cups in there. And there'll be surprises in there. But now we'll get the schedule, and then we'll have to see how the world unfolds till then. So how do we maneuver through this? We know that there's going to be a schedule change. We wait for it. And now the schedule is going to come out. So this week, I have a good idea of what the schedule is going to be. And I've been reworking my budget. And then I will give that information once I get the final schedule to our marketing department and stuff, and then see how they view it and how they're doing through all this, and see which events we can eliminate or do. I've got a lot of different things on the calendar. And then we wait and see what the governments do, and we wait and see what the airlines do, and we wait and see if we have to quarantine, and we wait and see and adapt to what challenges might be posed a couple months down the line.
Yeah, a lot of unknowns. Yeah.
But then now it's like, I think, like I say, because it's been so long, we're all in a very creative, adaptive mode, and willing to take what comes our way and just go with it, work with it, work around it. Deal with it. It's going to be interesting.
Is there a lot of lost money for teams with like accommodation that's had to be cancelled and stuff? Like, how flexible is all of that for you?
I can only speak to my experience. So far, everything's been fine for us. Typically book with the same people year after year. There's been one or two that have said, oh, yeah, it's non-refundable. Think about, the situation they're in too. And we fully expect to do the races in those places next year. So for the ones that were, weren't going to give a refund for the deposit, I'm just like, well, simply just put it for next year, because I know you people, we've been coming for 10 years, and they're sweet, fine. So zero money lost on that. And the flights that I did have in place weren't that many, and the airlines are going to be waiving change fees. So I have some credits there, but there's only a few big international ones. Even on EasyJet, I was able to cancel and have some credit. So this, very little money loss from my perspective for my team plans that I had in place.
Good stuff. Hopefully we get some racing going in the back end of the year, pushing us close to Christmas. And I was going to ask, is it true that you have a Christmas dinner for the team at some point during the year?
Yeah, that's true. It's true. Oh, I just always say that because we haven't had it. And I was thinking I was going to, I usually do it in Fort William because they've got like, you can go down the main street there and they've got like all kinds of little shops, and you always find little Christmas things. And then I wrap up stupid gifts and funny shit for the guys, and a couple of bottles of booze. And then we have this funny gift exchange, and everyone has a really good time. And I think it really hits home for a lot of the writers and things, it's, I think it's dear to some of their hearts, and some of the other ones maybe think it's corny, but yeah, because it's like, the reason what started it is we are a family and we're typically not together in December. So like, okay, we'll have our family Christmas dinner in June or whenever. So it will happen. I think it might happen in Lusa. Yeah. When we go back to Lusa, the place we stay there. Oh, the people are so lovely. We've been going there for years. They're family. They're family. We rent out their whole farmhouse and they have a dining room with a big, big table. You can seat everybody around. And I think that'd be the perfect place for it.
Awesome. Yeah. The track looks great too, as well. So hopefully we do get back there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the plan. We hope to see that.
Cool. Yeah. All right. So based on everything that you know, then with, was it 16 years with the syndicate now?
Oh God, yeah, I guess something like that. If I do the math. Yeah. Yeah.
So what advice would you give to other team managers or to people who manage groups of people in general?
Well, I think the first thing I would say is recognize their own strengths and abilities and honor those. Don't try and emulate someone else. Because every single team manager, I just told you, we're all friends, we all get along, but we're all completely different. We all bring different skill sets into the team management. We all have different roles to play. So just come in with your strengths and honor those. And yeah, that's pretty much the best advice I could give. Yeah.
Yeah. You can't
emulate somebody else. Yeah, be true to yourself. You wouldn't be in the team management role if you didn't have some type of skills and abilities to execute that role. So, yeah. That's what I would say.
So over those big chunky years with the syndicate, then what are the biggest standout moments for you? Are they wins? Are they team vibe? God. Or are they just comedy moments from random nights after races? Or
All of the above. But the ones that really get me like emotionally, the perfect example that encapsulates the super high and super low was World Championships when Steve won and Greg lost by 5/100ths of a second. Like, okay, amazing. Both, oh my God, Steve won, finally crying. Wow, amazing. Oh shit, Greg almost won. We fucking lost. That's the biggest loss by 5/100ths. Oh my God, that's a horrible loss. And geez, but I got a gold and silver medal. Yay!
Yeah, it's an emotional roller coaster, isn't it, for you in that role?
Oh my God, that was total emotional roller coaster. And then in that week, here we are in Australia, Greg's beloved grandmother died, and I almost had him go home and not even do the race. And then for him to go through all that emotion and still stick it out, I gave him that choice. You know, you do what you want. Because no, I'll stay. They'd want me to stay and race. Okay. Yeah. So that was, highs and lows. And then, the comedy moments. And then the ones where the guys are doing stuff that make me mad and I yell at them. And that's funny. Josh having girls come in and out the windows. And it's fun stuff. Fun stuff. Oh yeah, there's just so much. It's endless. And then the laughs. Oh, the laughs. Oh, it's too good. It's rich. The whole experience is so emotionally rich. It's amazing.
And you've got a pretty good Freddie Mercury impersonator on the team as well now.
How good is he? Oh my God, he's so good. Particularly after the movie came out with Rami Malek as the actor. Like, I'm like, dude, you look just like him. Like, I'm going to, like, if you're okay with it, I'm going to start collecting stuff for a outfit here. Yeah, so he's like, okay. And then once he sees I really did collect all, he's like, oh shit, now I got to do this. And I'm like, no, you don't have to do anything, but let's just make sure the teeth fit, because I ordered them from like a place that makes like dental stuff, right? So you mold them to your own teeth. They're not like 10 cent teeth. They're like actual Freddie Mercury teeth. So funny. And the night we were like, okay, Loris, we've got to fit these teeth just so we make sure, because it's like at any moment we may say, hey, go get dressed or don't get dressed in this, but let's make sure your teeth fit. And oh my God, I was pissing myself. Oh my God, I was dying. I get way more fun out of this stuff than these guys do. That's for sure. And then it's like, so we were in Leger, right? And so it's like, okay, well, we'll just have everything ready because we're doing this Santa Cruz party in the pit after. Okay. That party's happening anyways. But, you know, if it works out and I managed to contact one of the guys who worked for Santa Cruz in France, he's like, do you know where we can get a smoke machine? He's like, oh, I've got one. I'm like, oh my God, awesome. So get a smoke machine. And we had the karaoke machine for the music, which in the end, there were so many people in there, you couldn't even hear the song we were playing. But it's like, okay, I don't know if Freddie Mercury's coming or not, because, you know, how is he going to do in the race? Like, if he does really good, then maybe he'll be happy to come out or not. And then, yeah, and he did well. He's on the podium. And then I'm like, hey, it's up to you if you want to do this or not. And he goes, I'll do it. Okay. He says, okay, I'll do it. I'm like, okay. We're in the track. And oh my God. He puts the clothes on, and then when he puts the teeth in, I freaking lost my mind. And then, he was shy to come out for a little bit, and then Jordy was there, and then Jordy decided to be a part of it, and he's wearing Greg's gay pride tank top, and they came out together, and it was a shy Freddie Mercury for a moment as he made his grand entrance and kind of tried to blend into the crowd afterwards. Lewis is good, but oh my God, he's the ringer for him. So
classic
funny.
Moments.
Oh my gosh. Good stuff. So funny.
Cool. Yeah. Well, we're getting close to the end of our time, but we've got four questions that we ask everyone at the end. Okay. First one of those, if our listeners had £150, which is about $180 at the moment, to improve their performance on a bike, what would you recommend they go and spend it on?
Mental performance books.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got any standout books that you'd recommend? Or
there was one they had. I can't remember the name, but I haven't seen it in years. No, I can't answer that question right
okay.
now. But yeah,
type that into Google and see what comes up.
Yeah. Just see what comes up, because you think about people, especially that they're up and coming, are spending a lot of time on their bikes, and they're probably very fit and they probably have very good skills. But if you look at the pie, how much of their time are they doing on their mental training? Probably very little. So I would say invest your money into some, you know, if you want to perform, like I'm talking about for racing and stuff. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Good stuff.
Mental performance.
All right. Second question. If you could wind back the clock and sit down with yourself age 16, what advice would you give her?
I would say you're going to have one hell of a wild ride. Get your passport ready.
Excellent.
Watch out for your liver.
Good stuff. All right. Third question. If you could have a coaching session with anyone, past or present, who would it be and what would you want to learn from them?
That's a good question. I would have wanted to have, let's see, if I can have any coach in the world. I can't think of who it would be, but it would be when I was racing, and it would have been about the same topic, what I said, about the mental training. Like if someone had told me early on in my career some of these mental aspects, I would have had a lot better performances with a lot less doubt. So. Okay. Who's a good coach? Stefan Gerard. I'll say Stefan Gerard.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Or Rob Copeland helps Steve as well.
Yeah. He'd be a good one.
Both very smart guys. Cool. Yeah. All right. Last one. What do you personally do every day that you feel benefits you?
I walk at least 4 miles a day or run as my knee is improving. And I get out in nature and, I just make sure I'm out in nature, and particularly since we're not in the mountains right now too, when I'm going through my woods, I just am visualizing like, oh, this could be walking down a downhill track. Just every day getting outdoors, whether it be on bike, but out in nature on those single tracks out in the woods. I guess in some places they call it forest bathing.
Yes, I've heard that term. I like it. Sounds fun.
Yeah, we could say it's that.
Cool. Nice one. Yeah. So if people want to keep up to date with what you're up to, where's the best place for them to look?
Oh, for me, myself, I'm not really big on social media stuff. You know, I'm old. Facebook, I put stuff on Facebook. Nobody does that anymore. Instagram, I've got. I'm mostly just barely reposting stuff. I'm kind of not so good at that stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
So syndicate Instagram then.
Yeah. I'd say. Or Downtime Podcast. Find me here.
Well, there you go. Good stuff. Well, thanks so much for your time today, Kathy. It's been really interesting chatting and finding out more about your career so far. Yeah. And hopefully we'll be back out on the road soon for some racing and some laughs.
Yeah, I expect we will. I really do. Very hopeful for that. So yeah, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Good stuff. Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot.
You broke up my Groundhog Day. Thank you.
Brilliant. Cheers, Kathy.
Okay, take care. Bye.
All right. That's it for this episode with Kathy. I hope you've enjoyed listening. A massive thanks to PNW Components and We Are One Composites for supporting this episode. Don't forget to head to pnwcomponents.com and check out their awesome range of products. As a Downtime listener, you get 15% off using the code PNWDOWNTIME at the checkout. That's PNW Downtime, all one word, all in lowercase. Also, make sure you head over to wearonecomposites.com and check out their great range of wheels and the depackaged bar and stem. If you're tempted, then you can make the most of being a Downtime listener by using the code HANDLAY2020 at the checkout for 15% off all stock items. That's HANDLAID followed by the number 2020, all lowercase. All the links you need are in the show notes for this episode over on downtimepodcast.com. Go and check out all of our new merch over at downtimepodcast.com/shop, where you can pick yourself up some new threads and help support the podcast at the same time. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss an episode, and also please keep on spreading the word. You can do that by telling your friends or by sharing our episodes in whatever way works best for you. The more people that listen, the easier it gets for me to keep this thing going, so spreading the word really helps make sure that this podcast stays on air. All right, we've got another awesome episode coming up soon, but until then, look after each other, and if it's okay to do so, then get out and ride.